Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. Our guest today is Philip Koch. He's a professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore, specializing in landscape realism. He's also been a Clark Hulings Fund grant review panelist for 3 years running. Phil, can you take a minute and just tell us a little about your background and what you do?
Daniel, sure, and thanks for having me on the podcast. I originally was going to be a sociologist or an historian, but I took a required art history class my first semester, my freshman year at Oberlin College, and it just got me really interested in shifting gears. So I dropped everything, became a studio art major, and painted abstractly for a couple of years, fell in love with the work of the American realist Edward Hopper, and switched to realism after about 2 years. And I've been doing essentially landscape painting ever since. I've been at it for, somewhere between 45 and 50 years. So if I'm not good by now, there's no hope for me.
So you changed from abstract art to realism and landscapes, but how exactly did you manage to cross that abstract realism divide?
Oh, with great difficulty, Daniel. I hadn't really done much drawing as a kid, and so I had to really apprentice myself to looking at the world hard and long. I spent about 2 years just drawing everything, and then finally realized what I needed was the extra challenge and excitement of drawing from the live model. So I fortunately was able to get in front of several life-drawing class situations and spend about two years just drawing the nude. It trained my eye in wonderful ways that have proven incredibly useful for everything I've done since being an art student. Right now I teach a life-drawing class at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and I'm convinced it's one of the most useful classes that we have there. I don't think anybody is sorry after they've done it, because they learn to see differently. And, you know, bottom line, art is visual art. If it doesn't look good, it isn't good. So you got to train your eye to be able to discern the shapes that will tell your story.
I'm curious if you think that some genres, some artistic styles have an easier entry point than others, or if it's just difficult to cross the divide itself?
By easier entry point, you mean ease of doing, of executing them?
Is it easier to get into becoming that style, to becoming, say, an abstract artist versus a realist? Is the price of entry lower? Is the concentration less? I'm curious what you think about the requirements of each genre. So, for instance, it may be more difficult to play a trombone than a tuba in some ways, or maybe the tuba player would argue it's the other way around.
I'll have to check out the tuba. I'm not sure. You know, I honestly think to do either well is incredibly difficult. I often wonder, Daniel, if you look at different styles of, well, let's just look at painting, which is, you know, my area of concentration. I often ask myself, now, are there more poorly done landscape paintings than any other subject matter, or are there more poorly done abstract paintings? Because you can find lots of evidence in either direction that there's, right, you know, there's a mountain of each. So it's a really good question. I certainly think when someone is starting out, working abstractly is a very, very good background to help you see the surface and pull out shapes. But it's something that's it's easy to fool yourself that you're doing something a little more significant than you may actually be accomplishing. You know, one thing you can say for working in a realist version is there's just a little more disciplined looking that has to go on. My own particular brand of realism is one that does not rely on photography. I do everything with my landscape paintings either from direct observation or from memory. or just plain inventing it in my head. And I think that's technically much more challenging. Obviously, I'm a real partisan of realist landscape painting. I think all artists do the work that they think is most important and most satisfying. And so, of course, I feel that realism is psychologically the most gripping and ultimately the most meaningful branch of the art world. But it is not the only valid branch of the art world by any means.
I think part of what you're saying is that you can't fake, you can't take shortcuts regardless of the style. And while any one style may not be easier than the other or require more commitment or discipline than the other, it is... that there may be differing temptations to take shortcuts as a student or as a young artist with realism versus, say, abstract or another art form.
I love your phrase, differing temptations. I think I'm going to steal that.
Well, I wonder if you think that, what's your perspective about genre biases? Like, can genre biases from others, not from the artists, but from, can the attitudes at a given time that favor a particular artistic style, which we know we've gone through different phases, right? Can those attitudes prevent artists from reaching their full potential or being taken seriously in a market? And another, I guess, corollary question is, does the artist really have to roll with the times and focus on what people are buying now?
Yeah, but that's a wonderful question. And actually, I have a quick story that kind of relates to that. Over the years, I've gotten to know a lot of artists, and I've gotten to know two world-famous artists somewhat well. And both of these people were people that I saw as at the absolute pinnacle of success. And both of them confessed to me that they feel they've been treated terribly by the art world, and that they feel they've been ignored. And this, Daniel, really shocked me as I was listening to their story. And I realized that bitterness and disappointment are really enemies of all artists. We all need to fight that. Yeah, actually, could I go back to that point I was making with that story, just to finish it off a little more? I of course, there are fashions in the art world. And you can never, I think, predict where the art world is going to go next. And it would be foolish to try. And, you know, bottom line, you have to do the work that is most important to you. Otherwise, you're just in the wrong line of work altogether. In the long run, I think the best answer is there really is no one art world that an artist wants to address or should be trying to address with his or her work. There are many, many separate art worlds, many separate audiences, and the only advice that I think anybody should follow is just do the work that's important to you. You know, in your studio, you know, develop your vision and follow that relentlessly to where it needs to go, and then go out and find an audience for that work. That might mean building that audience one person at a time, but that is the only way for you can have real achievement and real quality coming out of your studio. Chasing after fashions, I think, is a terribly short-sighted thing to do. Especially when you've been in the around the art world or art worlds for a while, you watch a taste change. You watch different artists be on the cover of Art News every decade, and you realize that nobody or very few artists have that kind of staying power to be the blue chip artist for decade after decade. That's a very unrealistic goal. And I think it's bound to lead people to be very, very disappointed if that's how they orient their efforts.
Mm. Well, let me ask you, so, you know, Edward Hopper has been a big inspiration for you. Does the creative avant-garde of this area, this period, this era, really need to learn from our predecessors in order to be effective as professionals and artists? Or can we just sort of break out almost as though immune to history?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Boy, I feel very strongly that we cannot genuinely break out. you know, without really looking backwards and taking the, grabbing a hold of the most important threads that wind their way through art history. Obviously, our task in the 21st century, Daniel, is not to recreate the work that was being done in 1950, but we've got to chew on the same bones of the, you know, the big themes in art, you know, how the world is big, how we are small, how relationships are possible, how relationships are fragile. These are things that art talks about in all kinds of different ways. The people who went down the path before us as artists were just as smart as we are. They had just as good a sense of humor. And they did their part to develop this language, the visual language that we've been working on as humans for, you know, many, many centuries. To turn away from that language makes no sense at all. A really good analogy would be, imagine, Daniel, if I asked you to write a novel and get it to me within a month, but you have to make up a whole new language to write it in. I mean, you'd say, you would throw up your hands and say, why would I move away from the wonderful languages that I've learned and that I'm fluent with? You know, I have a story to tell. Let me work with the language I've been given. Visual artists, we're like novelists, and we have been given a terrific language. The story we tell is going to be different in every case. And given that this is the 21st century, you know, I think reality, the fact of being alive, feels different now than it did to a painter in 1950 or 1850. Almost without thinking about it, we're going to be doing something original. I don't think you can ever really be outside your time. And I don't think you can ever be really fully aware of all the things you're doing with your paintbrush. You know, it's coming from your conscious mind. But I think more of your decisions are coming from your unconscious, that you're going to be of your time, and you're going to be doing something that is a statement about here and now. Now, some artists are going to borrow more from the past, more of the language and grammar from the past than others. But anybody who ignores the past completely, I think it's sort of guaranteeing that they'll be very superficial. Frankly, you know, an awful lot of the contemporary art world is terribly superficial. I mean, this, you don't have to look far to find work that people are, well, everybody has some favorite avant-garde art that they think is absolutely ridiculous. I've got mine. I bet you've got yours. It won't be around 10 years from now in almost every case. Artists who, I think, find some threads from the past that are important to them personally, their work is going to be around and looked at 10, 100 years from now.
Well, you know, we make that argument in music a lot. You know, unless you really dig into somebody like Bob Dylan or Townes Van Zandt, it's really hard to get a handle on the trajectory of American music. No band that's ever hit it big has ever not had some pretty significant historical influences. And you can probably tell that I ask you a lot of these questions because you teach. And I'm wondering, you know, in light of the influence that Hopper's work has had on your life, what responsibility do you think that we have in passing our knowledge to the next generation? And what exactly inspired you to teach? Do you feel like it's an obligation? Or are there really other reasons that drive you and it's not a sense of obligation?
Right. Can I be brutally honest?
Yeah.
When I first started teaching, I hated it. I absolutely hated teaching. I felt very ineffective as a teacher, and I don't think I was a very good teacher. I was doing it to pay the rent. And I was very fortunate that I got a job at a really wonderful art school that has been a big supporter. It has allowed me to be an artist in a very active way through decades. Over time, my attitude towards teaching has shifted profoundly to where I actually have come to really look forward to going in to class, primarily because of what you're hinting at. I had, Daniel, some wonderful teachers, painting teachers. I had a lot of other teachers that weren't so good, but the ones that really helped me, I am so grateful to, and I would not be where I am today had I not had those experiences with them. I think the only way to repay the debt is to do what artists have always done, which is to try as best they can to lead the next generation in the search they have to undertake. It's a very tricky business figuring out what teaching art means. Every artist is going to have a different answer for that. But I do think it's something that is just part of that wonderful chain of wonderful continuity of artists from one generation influencing the next. You know, I see my work as very influenced by Edward Hopper. Edward Hopper was clearly influenced by the American painter Winslow Homer. Winslow Homer was clearly influenced by 19th century French painting, and so on. It goes all the way on back. There's a great honor, and I think even an excitement, in finding your place on that long chain of artists as we, you know, go through time together. So I think the teaching aspect is terribly important. It's interesting that Edward Hopper, who was probably the biggest influence on my own work, taught lessons in his parents' living room when he was a teenager and into his 20s. And he confessed that he was an absolutely dreadful teacher, and he hated teaching. And I think that's a wonderful bit of candor on his part.
Yeah, those are all interesting points. You know, I see you situating artistic endeavor in terms of a dialogue with those that have gone before, but then necessarily those that go after. So there's that come after. So there's really a link between being part of a historical tradition and teaching. It sort of joins the before and the after together. And, you know, to some degree, I remember Leonard Bernstein gave six talks at Harvard where he kind of delved into this transformational grammar we get from Noam Chomsky and suggested there might be a universal grammar of art, a universal grammar in which we can carry on a dialogue regardless of genre or historical influence or national influence or style. And I think some of that is what you're articulating when you you put this into perspective for us.
Yeah. Oh, I very much think there is it's almost a hidden grammar. You know, it's something that is usually below our level of awareness, but you know, who really knows how the human mind works, how we experience reality? I do think there are some sorts of templates or archetypes of form that each generation of visual artist or musician tries to approach. And I think these forms probably change a little bit as for each generation. You know, that I don't think artists in the 1930s saw and felt reality the way you and I do. And in the unconscious that they carried in their minds, I think forms presented themselves a little differently. I think this is why every society wants to have some kind of art and have some kind of music, is there's a sense that it's telling us something we need to know. And also, there's a great deal of pleasure that goes along with it. You know, there's a pleasure to the eye, there's a pleasure to the ear, but it's a deeper pleasure. It's a pleasure that is satisfying in a long-lasting kind of way. There's nothing moralistic one way or another about this, but, you know, there's something about this language that does seem to hint that there's a shared universal grammar, although I think it does evolve over time. This is getting really abstruse. You know, what's really funny is I try when I'm teaching and also when I'm painting to really focus on what's in front of my eyes. On the other hand, you know, artists spend a lot of time alone. It takes a long time to execute the work, no matter what medium you're in. I mean, even digital work takes a really long time to get it right. And you can't help but find yourself wondering, what does this mean? Why do we do this? Why have artists always been around? Why will we always have our artists? What is it we're trying to accomplish? It's elusive as all heck, but it's really fun to speculate about. On the other hand, speculating about the meaning of art is very different than making art that is meaningful. And that's where you have to get your hands dirty.
Well, so we are about to actually move from the abstruse into the more concrete as we shift gears, because in this part of the show, I want to ask you a little bit about your role as an artist in terms of your business. So can you talk about how you marketed yourself as an artist at the beginning of your career versus how you do it now?
Oh, I'm laughing. At the beginning of my career, I was just working very hard to make my work really good, which is every young artist's job, of course. But I was completely confident, as were all my classmates, that as soon as I reached a certain level of accomplishment, the door to my studio would be flung open by curators, gallery directors, and collectors, waving money and fame in my face. And I figured, well, if it didn't happen this year, well, next year, for sure. And I think that's an illusion that all artists in their youth have to wrestle with. It takes a certain kind of personality to think you can do something significant in visual art or in music. You have to have a vision that you think is really important. You have to feel you have a unique way of looking at things. And all that's true, it can, I think, blind you to the fact that, well, gosh, maybe we're not that important, and maybe the world's not going to be the path to our door. So I gradually got tired of waiting, Daniel, for people to come to me, and I started realizing I needed to get the work out of my studio and in front of other people, really any way I could. The funny thing, and I think this is where I've been very fortunate, I know many artists find having an exhibition of their work terrifying, you know, the fear of rejection, or at least the fear of being ignored. I always kind of enjoyed it. I liked very much the chance to put the work out there and get at least some response from new people. I think being in a show or having a show, getting your work online, I think it's very exciting. I always learn a lot of seeing my work in a different setting. And I think in some ways I'm just a very fortunate artist that fear of rejection, and I'm as insecure emotionally as anybody. I mean, I'm not the most well-grounded, permanently happy, optimistic individual that we'd all like to be. I mean, I have my dents, too. But for some reason, I seem to be able to weather the insecurities of putting the work out there more easily than some of my other artist friends. I don't know why that is, but it's something where I've been very fortunate. What I would say about getting started with marketing is I had a show at a gallery a nonprofit gallery in Baltimore that was run by the Alumni Association of the Maryland Institute College of Art, and I actually sold a couple pieces out of the show. But most of all, I just was shocked at how exciting it was. And to be honest, what an ego trip it was to have a solo show. I liked how it felt. I liked how the work looked. You know, to see it on somebody else's wall under good lighting situations. It's terribly, terribly exciting. And I realized I wanted to have another show. I wanted to get my work seen other places. So I would recommend this to any younger artist. There's a certain period where you should do anything you can do to get the work seen. I showed my work in public libraries locally. I showed my work in restaurants. I showed my work in these juried shows where in the old days you sent 35mm slides through the mail. Now you do it, of course, just sending a digital file, which is easier. And, you know, all of that was useful. Over time, what started to happen is commercial galleries started to be a more realistic target, commercial art galleries, and I realized that I really should start trying to approach them. I don't think anybody right out of school is, in most cases, going to be attractive enough to a commercial art gallery. But once you've been at it for, I would say, a few years after school, 5 years out, I think galleries start to realize, wait a minute, this is not some hobbyist. This is someone who's probably going to be around 10 years from now and still producing art. So, you know, once you have some, you know, a real track record, once you've got a body of work built up, and once the style of how your work, the work that's coming out of your brush, once it starts to look a little bit consistent, where you're, you know, focusing in on a certain way of seeing, you know, then you become of interest, your work becomes of interest to commercial art galleries. I think commercial art galleries are a very, very important tool for most artists. They can reach people that you as an artist cannot. Basically, what an art gallery is, it's not a building, it's not a website, it's a network of people that the art dealer has assembled usually painstakingly one at a time, of people who are used to looking to this art dealer for advice about what is significant in the art world, work that they should come and look at. And to get access to that group of people that the art dealer has worked usually very hard to assemble, you know, you need to be part of that gallery. You know, galleries come and go, and I've worked with probably 50 different galleries over the years, from very obscure to big blue chip galleries. But I think in general, it's been a very positive experience. Not an easy experience, but it has brought my work much, much more attention than I could possibly have done on my own.
So how did you get your work into galleries? I mean, what was your strategy? Did you did you do one-man shows? Did you pick particular galleries that, you know, targeted their best customers? Did you just hang things for visitors to discover? What was, you mentioned the importance, but how did you make it happen?
Yeah. Well, I think the big thing is just to be persistent. In fact, I think a really good thing to think about is that in some ways you need to collect rejections, you know, because there are simply not enough opportunities out there for the number of decent artists who are producing work. And so just the numbers are really stacked against any young artist, or stacked against an artist of any age. So basically, you need to get your work seen by gallery directors repeatedly. My method, when I would have a show anywhere, including in some very modest shows, I was starting out back before email, when, you know, to send out an announcement meant a postal thing. I used to make up a postcard, you know, with a reproduction on the front and my name on the back and the show times and all that, the standard gallery announcement. And I started building a mailing list of galleries that I would like to show at. And I tried to look for galleries that would be interested in the kind of work I had. And I would approach some galleries that were prestigious, that would be a real stretch to get into, and also some galleries that would be much more likely to accept my work. I think I see artists making two different kinds of mistakes at this stage of their career. There are some artists who only want to show in a big gallery in New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, and they feel that it would be a waste of time and it would use up their work to show in St. Louis. And so they'll only apply to the big city, big name galleries. And then there's another mistake that artists will always kind of lowball themselves, and they'll join the local art league, which is a good thing to do, and participate in the local art league's annual show at the town hall. And that is the sum total of their exhibition outreach. And, you know, somewhere in the middle, I think an artist wants to be trying for opportunities that they have a good chance of getting, but also apply to some things that will be a little bit of a stretch. If you keep at it and keep sending out, what I did, I kept at it, I sent out announcements to a couple hundred art galleries eventually. I built my mailing list up that big. And eventually the galleries start wanting you to send them images of work to consider taking into the gallery. I think what's really key is don't get discouraged. You know, the galleries are very busy. They are approached by so many artists. Sometimes they can be profoundly rude to an aspiring artist who's asking them to look at the dealer, to look at your work. It's not personal. They have many artists asking them the same question, will you look at my work, every week. You know, they're sitting there wondering why potential collectors aren't coming through the door. Instead, they're getting phone calls and artists coming through the door with portfolios. And they can be, difficult. And if that's going to stop you, because your feelings may be hurt when they say, no, I'm not interested, or no, your work's not for us, or they could say something more hurtful than that. It comes down to, you know, how much do you want to continue being an artist? Are you going to let this person who rejected you this time have that much power over you? I don't know any artist who has a thick skin. I mean, the advice is always develop a thick skin. I don't know anyone who's learned how to do that. I think rejection always is painful. but it's something that it's an experience all artists share. All artists have to be rejected far more than they're accepted. If you have developed a way of working, if you're developing a vision that is right for who you are, if you know that you've put in the time and made your work really, really good and really meaningful, I feel you owe it to the work to keep going and to keep approaching galleries. So getting back to the concrete question, Daniel, you asked, I did it primarily through sending out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of postcards, and then from time to time I would mail in portfolios. Nowadays, it's easier in one sense because you can just send JPEG visual files, so JPEGs, to galleries with the press of a button. The downside is everybody else is doing that too, and so the chances of the director of an art gallery just hitting the delete button are very, very high. So what I would recommend to any artist is to do a combination of email approaches, sending images to galleries that you've researched and think would be interested in the kind of work you do, and send them something through the Postal Service. Almost nobody sends out things through the U.S. mail anymore. If you want to stand out, what a terrific way to do it, because no one else is doing it anymore. So I very pridefully put stamps on envelopes and stamps on postcards to this day, and I think it's just a critical component. The last thing I'd want to add to that is, there's some artists who are more extroverted than others. I don't think in general visual artists tend to be extroverts, really just the opposite. But some people are really good at going up and meeting people face to face and getting a conversation going and sustaining it. And I'd say, to anybody who's got some skill in that direction or who enjoys that, go to the galleries, go to the openings, be there, be seen, meet the director, talk to them. For artists who are too shy, that doesn't mean you should never do that. Just don't do it as much. But, you need to get yourself out there a little. I don't think any artist has to become somebody they aren't. You always need to be who you are. Play to your strengths. If you are good face-to-face, fine. If not, find indirect ways of communicating with galleries.
So did the quantity of the work that you were putting out have an effect on galleries that would take your work? Did it help or did it hinder? And what role did quantity really play in your growth as an artist? Was it better to focus on producing a lot of work quickly or to agonize over individual pieces?
I like your choice of verbs, agonize, because that's exactly what it is. One thing that's so funny, Daniel, is I read some of those career advice books for artists, and they all have something good to say. I mean, I've never met one of these career advice for the visual arts books that I thought was totally wrong. But the truth is, you do need to have a lot of output. You need a big body of work. But much more important than that, it's got to be good work. And for most artists, spending longer on a piece makes the piece better. And the whole point of this is to do work that is important and that you're confident is worthy. And for most artists, that means spending a lot of time on it, almost a comical amount of time, and agonizing to get it right is just the name of the game. So you want to produce, you do need to work a lot. I mean, artists tend to spend a lot of time alone. We don't go out much. We're actually some of the dullest people in the world socially. But you need to spend a lot of time working on your work. I do think it's better to do less work numerically and have it be of higher quality than to work faster than you really should be working. Every artist, of course, works differently. There are some artists that can produce a couple hundred pieces a year. I think it's very rare that there's much quality there. Will they have initial success in the art world? Yeah, probably, when their prices are low. If you're selling a piece for $200, you will find someone out there to buy it. As you produce fewer pieces, you can't afford to let them go for so little. But if you're in it for the long haul, which I think, I think the other artists I respect are, it's really better to slow down. I do wish I had more work. I never seem to have the right painting at the right time. But that's just a problem. I suppose musicians wish they could clone themselves so they could play out at several different clubs simultaneously. But that would be hard to do.
If you could do one thing differently that you know now versus how you handled it at the beginning of your career, or you could just do something differently in the trajectory of your career, what would that be?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I wish I hadn't let fear of rejection play as prominent a role as I did when I was a young artist. I'm very typical of younger people. What you perceive other people thinking of you plays too big a hand. Nowadays, I realize, there's, if somebody doesn't like the work you're doing here, there's somebody down the street who will. There's always somebody out there who will find some of the excitement that you feel in your work. You just have to get your work seen by other people. There's always going to be rejection. I don't have a thicker skin, but I think I've come to see that, people are different. They respond to different things. There are artists out there whose work I think is terrific, who have virtually no audience, and then there's the opposite. And you just can't take it that seriously, the response you get to your work. I know the work in the end, if it's good, it will stand on its own and will be in museums after you're gone. And just be confident that you're making the best work you can. And what so-and-so thinks of it, it really doesn't matter. Also, the thing that's got to be said about the business end of the art world, it's about selling things. And dealers are interested in what they think their clients will buy. When they reject you, it's never that they don't think the work has some merit. It's always that this dealer does not have the clients in their back pocket that they think would be interested in your work. It's very hard to keep the gallery doors open. I mean, that's got to be just a killer job, being an art dealer. And so, understanding that, having watched so many galleries open and then go out of business, I just realized you can't take what a dealer says to you that seriously. And that said, I've had a lot of good experiences with dealers. I mean, I'm talking very negatively, but it's a tough business. Most galleries go out of business within 3 years, and so that means you have to go get your work and bring it back. You just be prepared for that. Look, it was hard for Rembrandt. Why would anybody think it's going to be easy for us? In some ways, it has changed very little.
For the Clark Healings Fund, you're a panelist and have been for about 3 years. So what's been your experience there, your biggest takeaway reviewing other people's business proposals for their art business?
You know what's funny is, Clark Healings, the painter, was a very traditional painter. And so I think the thing that really surprised me was who ended up applying for this grant. In almost every case, they were not traditionally oriented. And because I was fully expecting, Western imagery, Rocky Mountains and desert landscapes, and we've seen almost none of that. We've seen a lot of good abstract work. We've seen a lot of good sculpture. And it's just, I'm kind of amazed and perplexed by it. It goes to show that, you think you know what's going on, and then you realize that, no, you really don't know what's going on at all. So that's been a real big surprise. On the other hand, that's been really fun. I mean, I like that Healings Fund has been attracting different applicants than one would think would be attracted to it. So I don't understand why that is, but it's been a happy surprise for me. The other thing I want to say is that, a lot of artists out there are very good at presenting themselves. They figure out what body of work to present that has a consistency of vision but isn't monotonous. You don't want all the pieces to look alike. On the other hand, you want the same kind of emotional tone to resonate through the portfolio you're presenting. And a lot of artists have gotten very good at that, I think just probably by the process of applying to many, many things over time. And so I would recommend to people that they apply for grants, apply for jury shows, to just to see how the process works. You always learn something when you do that about, gee, when I presented my work this way, I got a better response than when I presented it that other way. It has to be, just like making a painting, a trial and error proposition.
So, Philip, if you could have one technology or one superpower to do something that you're currently not able to do with your art or career, what is that thing?
Oh, boy, what a wonderful fantasy. A superpower or technology. Telekinesis. I would like to be able to think the paint off the palette and onto the painting without having to get my hands dirty. I would just want to sit back with my feet up and just be able to visualize what I want to paint and have it appear magically on the surface of the canvas. It's not likely to happen. As it is, we always struggle with technical problems. One of the things about painting too, if you look at the work of artists in the past, like technical prowess, an artist like Edward Hopper, who I think is probably the best painter of brilliant sunlight ever, he was not in other ways the most technically skillful artist. He did some incredibly beautiful figure paintings. Other times his figures can be kind of awkward. There are proportion problems. And sometimes his figures just look kind of lifeless. Nonetheless, he went ahead and made the best paintings he possibly could with the technique that he had at hand. I think there's a terrific lesson there is that, and Robert Henri, the founder of the Ashcan School, first guy to give me this idea in that wonderful book that I recommend to everybody, The Art Spirit by Robert Henri. He said, paint a masterpiece today. He said to his students, paint a masterpiece today with the technical powers that you have now. Years from now, you may have more powers and you'll paint better masterpieces then. But he basically is saying, aim high, have a vision that's worthwhile and tell people your story. Don't wait doing technical exercises or learning the latest version of Photoshop's intricacies to produce your masterpiece. Work on your vision, work on that thing that has that emotional power, the story you want to tell, and the technique will follow. So I think maybe a better answer to the superpower question you asked me, Daniel, before would be, I'd like to refine my vision more, to be able to see it in my mind's eye a little more clearly, where it is I want to go with the next painting. I'd like to be able to visualize that painting in more clarity in my mind's eye, which is, I think, what all artists need to do, is to try to see around the bend a little bit farther so they're not groping their way forward so much. So in a nutshell, could I be magically made visually brilliant? I'll settle for visual brilliance.
I think that's probably a common wish. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. Philip Koch's website is philipkoch.org. For more information on the fund, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Philip. It's really been great having you.
Daniel, thank you very much. I'm honored.